You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York, the CJ Mars Radio Network.
The Paranormal News Insider from AmericanNewsInsider.com. Presented by CJMarsRadio.com.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for October 6th, 2015, and episode number 235. And this is your host, as always, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Now, this week's show is going to be talking about August. Yes, August. I know it's October. But August UFO sighting statistics, ghost photographed in a tunnel. Kind of a weird story here. And we're going to talk about ghosts in depth tonight. It's October. It's almost Halloween. We've got to get in that mood. So we're going to kind of stir up a little bit of stuff tonight talking about ghosts. And also we'll be talking conferences and conventions and maybe a little bit more. And this week's show is brought to you by the International The International Cryptozoology Museum, located in Portland, Maine. It's the world's only cryptozoology museum. The International Cryptozoology Museum opened in 2003 and contains rare and original items collected by Lauren Coleman, the director of the museum. Visit the International Cryptozoology Museum at 11 Avon Street in downtown Portland, Maine. You might need a boat to get there right now, but for more information, please visit cryptozoologymuseum.com. And I mentioned the International Cryptozoology Museum because my latest book, Handbook for the Amateur Cryptozoologist, is available at that location. Kind of cool. I can't wait to get up there to visit my books. It's to see the museum. It's an awesome treat. It's not full of exhibits all the time, but right now the Minnesota Iceman is up there, and I'd love to see that, read about that for years and years and years. So it's only going to be there till, I believe, January, so you need to get up to Maine and see that. It's really exciting. It's going to be moving next year as well, too, so get there now. Now to the news. What's going on in the news? Well, that's it for cryptozoology stuff. That's all you're going to hear tonight on cryptozoology. We're going to focus a little bit more about ghosts. But first, we're going to talk UFOs. Now, normally, MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, provides the sighting statistics about 2 weeks after the month ends. So the sighting statistics for August should have been out mid-September, about the 15th or so. But I didn't get them. Normally they email them out, but I think with the MUFON symposium that took place last month, I think they kind of got a little behind on emails. But I did get a hold of the sighting statistics, so I'm going to share those with you this week. And what I like to do as well with that is kind of go back and talk about the entire year, just to kind of give you a gauge as to what they're getting statistics-wise. And again, it's important to remember that MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, is based in the United States. So a majority of their cases come from the United States. Their sighting reports are here in the U.S. And looking back at January, there was 721 worldwide reports. February slipped a little bit. It's a shorter month. 607 reports. March had 684. April had 709. And May had a huge jump with 900 reports, with the United States having 737 of them. That's more than the entire grouping of the last few months. In June, the increase continued with the most UFO reports in a single month in MUFON history, with 1,402 reports. And with that, the United States had 1,180 reports, with Canada second with 84, and the United Kingdom third with 42. Well, July also had some big numbers, an increase of over 35% from the July of last year, with 1,353 reports this year. And again, like I said, I'm a little late with the August numbers, but it's interesting to see that there's been a little dip in those numbers, regardless of July and August both having the same amount of days and both being summer months. So a lot of people are out. The sun is up, you know, about the same amount of time, those 2 months. So it's kind of a weird question as to why there's such a dip. Not a huge dip, but they went from 1,353 reports in July down to 1,143 reports turned in August. Now, it's still above normal. The average is right around 700 typically, but there's been a huge increase this year, more or less due to Hangar One really gaining momentum. I believe it's in its second year on cable, on H2, the History Channel, one of those things. I don't really watch that much. I don't watch much paranormal programming at all, to be honest with you. But nonetheless, it's helped promote MUFON and get MUFON out there to a more wider audience. So a lot more people are looking to add their reports. And as they see things, they also report them to MUFON so they can be documented and hopefully investigated by the investigators that work for MUFON. Now, with this last month, the month of August, again, 1,143 worldwide reports. The United States had 827. Canada was second with 121. The United Kingdom turned in 61. And Australia finished fourth with 20. And then you got a steep drop off to Mexico that turned in only 8 reports. Now, Mexico has its own big network of a variety of UFO networks, most of them based in and around Mexico City, where the largest populace is in that area. But there's also other organizations around there that they turn their information into. A lot of them also turn it into some of the major news networks down there that have actual UFO investigators, like we would have here in the United States. We have people who investigate those inside stories of corruption or local businesses that are doing things wrong. A lot of those places down there actually have the TV stations down there have people that do strange occult or mainly UFO stories down there. So that's kind of an interesting thing that I learned a while ago. Now, with the amount of cases, again, 1,143 worldwide reports, United States with 827, there was a total of 51 countries that turned in reports to MUFON. But 26 of them only reported one sighting. And the ones I did not mention turned in 7 or less reports. Now, when you're breaking it down here in the United States, the distribution is basically as follows. California turned in the most reports with 112 of the total 827 reports. Now, I mentioned this last time I covered these sighting statistics. The big reason why California is number one is that it has the highest population of any state, but it is also the third highest square miles of land, following Texas and, of course, Alaska being the largest state in square miles. So with all that extra land and all those people, they're bound to see a little bit more UFO type activity, or at least purported UFO activity, than most of the other smaller states or less populous states. Pennsylvania finished second with 50 reports. New York was close with 48 reports. Florida had 41. And I wonder where Florida will finish in September. I'm trying to keep this in mind when those statistics come out for September. Hopefully in the next 2 weeks. I hope to have them next week. That would be great. I wonder where Florida will finish due to the Atlas V rocket launch that took place on September 2nd. That created quite a bit of confusion. Social media was blowing up with UFO pictures and stories and videos of people going, what is this? Even though it was well covered in the media, people still lost their marbles for lack of a better term, about what was happening down there in the early mornings of September 2nd. So keep that in mind for next month when those statistics come out. And after Florida, we have Texas. Texas was fifth with 40 sightings. And again, it's important to note that Texas ranks number two in population, according to the 2013 Census Bureau estimates. So again, with more people comes the chance of more reports. But a state with more population basically means less sightings per capita, which is also important because if a small state, like let's say Rhode Island, had 20 reports, that to me is more of a big deal than California having 40 reports, because per capita would be more per person or per group of people than a larger state. Let's see, who else? Arizona had 39 reports. Ohio had 35. Michigan turned in 32. Washington State had 30. Illinois had 26. New Jersey had 23. North Carolina with 22. Massachusetts and Oregon had 18 reports each. Tennessee had 17 reports. Colorado and Indiana had 16 UFO reports. And the remaining states had 15 or less reports in the month of August. And as always, big thanks to Jan C. Harzan, the executive director of MUFON, for the monthly sighting statistics, and especially this month for Colorado MUFON for helping me out in finding the statistics that I did not get in my email this month. But at any rate, looking forward to next month and seeing whether or not the trend continues of the UFO reports in the slight decline, and whether or not Florida is going to boost because of the Atlas V sighting. Now we go to ghost news. And ghost news, last week, I don't remember what day the story broke, but one of the few current stories that I'm following this week was a photograph taken by a truck driver that was entering a tunnel in Cork, Ireland. Now, over there, they drive on the wrong side of the cars and on the wrong side of the roads. Well, to them, it's the right side, but really and truly, it's the left side. Anyway, now that I have you completely confused, as the man and his colleague were entering the tunnel, a picture was taken of what looked to be a ghostly figure walking across the road. Well, the men guessed this was a ghost of a person who must have drowned in a nearby river. The initial reaction by most people that see this photograph is that it's just a reflection of something inside the cab that is reflecting off the glass. Well, I couldn't agree more. This fact is also obvious when you notice several other reflections within the frame of the photograph, and unfortunately it makes it one of the least convincing ghost photographs I've seen online in a while. But there for a while, we're getting a lot of ghost pictures on the internet. There's still a few now and again. In the last week, I've seen a small handful, but they're actually historical. They happened months ago, and one happened a couple of years ago. But the whole story is a little shaky. I would think that these guys probably knew what they were seeing, but I think they just wanted to see if they could get this out in the news and see how much popularity they could get. And if you see the picture, you'll hopefully see, when you first see it, and it's kind of small, it looks pretty convincing. It looks like there is an object crossing the road in front of the truck. And even the truck driver stated that they felt that they drove through this object. But they never stated that they actually saw it when the picture was taken. So it's a little conflicting of a story there. But when you see the picture and you blow it up and you really take a really good look at it, you'll notice that in the upper left-hand corner and the upper right-hand corner especially, there's a couple of little blobs that appear to be reflections from inside the cab. And you can clearly see the glass in this photograph of the windshield. And it looks like the camera is actually mounted in the middle of the cab, which makes me wonder whether or not it was just an actual video or whether or not they actually saw this when it was happening, or they just set it up to happen. Now, that being said, that's actually all the news I have for this week. It's been a very slow news week. I don't know what's going on. October is usually synonymous with this kind of stuff. August and September are usually booming with a lot of craziness. usually a lot of cryptid stories, UFO stories, and all kinds of craziness. But the crazy month for those of us in the paranormal is October. This is when we get a lot of requests for media. We do a lot of interviews. We do library appearances where most of us are on the run. And I call it the crazy month. Silly season, essentially, is what I call it. A lot of people think that that's Christmas for most regular people, but for those of us in the paranormal, it's October that keeps us running around. And I think that's part of the issue here, that a lot of the paranormal news outlets are kind of busy with a lot of other things. But there's not really a whole lot of stories out there in the media that I came across that were current. Now, there is a lot of older stories, and I did cover one last week on the Paranormal News Insider with crop circles, and I went the extra mile and brought you a little history of crop circles. Wait, that's what I do. I like to bring you a little bit of extra information with all of that. And if you want extra information on the story that I just mentioned with the truck driver, and you want to see that picture, you can go to the Facebook site for Paranormal News Insider at facebook.com/ParaNewsInsider. And that story is already up on the Facebook page, so you can check that out. Check out that picture and judge for yourself if that's really a ghost of a drowned person, or it's just a sock or something thrown up on the cab window there. So what else do we have to talk about? Well, I do have the book of the week, and it's an interesting book. I had another book picked out after last week to kind of go in a different direction. It was a little bit of an obscure book, but I want to keep the current themes going with current, semi-current books. Now, actually, this one's back from 2007 already. Seems like a long time ago, but it's still a very, very good book. And it's called Ghost Hunters. No, not those guys. Not those guys. Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. That's just a book written by a woman named Deborah Blum. She's really not anybody that's in with the paranormal. She's not a parapsychologist or anybody that's really related to anything with the parapsychology, the SPR, the ASPR, or anything like that, which is what William James helped found back in the late 1800s. She has a journalism degree from the University of Georgia, and she's essentially a science writer and did a ton of research for this book. And this book is, this is another one of those books, along with the ones that I mentioned last week with Lord Auerbach. This is an essential book. If you're a researcher, especially a researcher, now if you're an investigator, and you just like going to creepy, scary, cool places, it may not be a necessary piece of material for you. But if you're a researcher and you want to know more about the history of the paranormal, of psychical research, and the beginnings of what we do as amateur investigators, this is a book that you must read. It's a must read. It should be on everyone's list as a researcher. I highly recommend this book. Again, it came out in May of 2007. You can get it on, I'm looking at it right now on Amazon. You can get it for, you can get it for 3 cents on hardcover. I have a paperback version. You can get that as well. It's also available on Kindle. It's quite a read. It is pretty thick. It's 384 pages. A lot of interesting history. Now, this is history. And it essentially follows William James and his journey, not just through psychical research, but also through his life and a lot of the things that brought him into psychical research. And one of the interesting things, like I mentioned, is it's very well researched. This is as historically accurate as you're going to get as far as the beginnings of the American Society for Psychical Research. Now, the Society for Psychical Research, the SPR, started in 1882. The American version of the American Society, the American Society for Psychical Research, started in 1885, 3 years later. It started in Boston, Massachusetts, and then moved to New York City, where it is to this day. I'm a former member of the ASPR, no longer a member, a paying member, although I do still get a Christmas card every year from them, which is very nice. But the ASPR here in the United States is the foundation of what we do today. It's the foundation of ghost research, ghost investigations, and the field work that is done. And like I mentioned, this book is full of history, and it really and truly started with a book called The Night Side of Nature, which is covered here in this book, Ghost Hunters, William James, and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. Catherine Crowe's book, The Night Side of Nature, came out in 1848, which is a pivotal year for the age of spiritualism. Spiritualism is essentially not just the belief in the afterlife, but also the belief in the communication of the afterlife. And its kind of unofficial birth date is 1848. And part of that is responsible for the release of Catherine Crowe's book. It started out in England, but it quickly made its way over to here, and it really kind of legitimized the belief in ghosts. And it really was meant as just a collection of stories, but it really opened a lot of people's minds, and it kind of made it not so much taboo. And this, the same, you could kind of correlate that with myself starting in the paranormal in 1996. It was not mainstream. You really couldn't tell a lot of people you were doing what you're doing, because a lot of people would think you're crazy. And it wasn't until around 2004, when the TV show Ghost Hunters came out with Taps, that it began to become mainstream, and it became cool to what we do. And people started dressing out in black shirts with their logos and acting like rock stars, posing in cemeteries and things like that. It became cool. Well, back in those days, believing in spiritualism really wasn't cool. It was a very risky career move if you were a scientist. But Catherine Crowe's book opened the door for that. And one of the stories in Catherine Crowe's book was about the Fox sisters. Now, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the Fox sisters out of Hydesville, New York. Hydesville no longer exists on a map. But their story of person they called Mr. Splitfoot, where they were able to communicate through knocks and raps, which was a huge story in the New York area and a very large populace of the United States, and it really got a lot of people on the board, on the bandwagon with believing in spiritualism and getting behind the movement that was taking place at the time. And unfortunately, it kind of turned into a money-making scheme with a lot of people, psychics and mediums, which are two completely different things, became a money-making venture for a lot of people. And ultimately what happened is some scientists, like William James — William James was a philosopher, a very well-known philosopher and psychologist who was also trained as a physician. He was, a very recognized scientist in his day, graduated from Harvard University, very respected and tied to a lot of other scientists. Now, he, again, like I said, it wasn't mainstream until 1848. But it was shortly after that, about 10, 15 years, when William James and a lot of other people started to really get interested in what was going on with these claims. And they started to question what was going on, and they began to question psychics and mediums and into what they were doing and the legitimacy of what they were doing. Is the afterlife real? And can we communicate with the afterlife? These were questions that they wanted to answer. And again, the formal study of this started in 1882 in England with the Society for Psychical Research. And then William James and some of his close colleagues started the American version in 1885. And this book, Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death, again by Deborah Blum, that's B-L-U-M, this book came out in 2007, and again, it's if you're a researcher and you're really involved in ghost research, ghost investigation, this is a book you got to have. This I got it when it first came out, and I've read it twice. It's a fascinating book. It does kind of get a little bit more in depth into William James, and again, this is towards the end of his life. He died in 1910, and it it's more about him than the actual search for life after death, really and truly, when you really get in depth in reading it. But it's still fascinating to learn about him and the things he was involved in, and the characters and people that he played with as a psychical researcher trying to uncover the truth. So that's the book of the week. That's actually a topic that I'm going to continue to talk about here. Not psychical research, but the next phase of that. And that's parapsychology. So that's something that we're going to be digging into. What happened after this? What happened after psychical research? And where do we get to today? Since there's not a whole lot of news, I figured I'm going to take some time to throw out some educational pieces and talk about some of the stuff that I deal with, that I talk about in different venues and different areas of what I do. And one of the topics is parapsychology. Now, parapsychology is kind of glorified because of it's really the biggest piece that we have. It's the biggest kind of organized science that's helped us discover what we know so far about ghosts. And without this information, we would be pretty lost. And a majority of what we know about the paranormal has come from parapsychology. But keep in mind that it's not the end-all, be-all thing that it seems to be, and it's actually very limited. But again, it's critical, and it's critical that anybody involved in any type of paranormal investigation should know at least the history of parapsychology and the basics of parapsychology, because if you don't understand what's already been learned, what scientists have already discovered, you're kind of limiting yourself, and you're just kind of guessing as you go along. And TV shows aren't going to teach you all this stuff. A certification on parapsychology, well, I'll talk a little bit more about the educational aspect towards the end of this, but kind of just to jump in real quick, I've already mentioned some of parapsychology. Now, I mentioned psychical research, and kind of to differentiate the two, because they are kind of much, much different. Psychical research dealt with essentially observation. I guess you could break it down to one word. It would be observation. And essentially, yes, it was with psychics and mediums. And they also investigated cases of ghosts, very similar to how we would investigate in this day and age, but they didn't tote around tools and technology. It was more of dealing with the client, interviewing people, and observing the environment. But mostly they were just taking case studies. So they were documenting what people had seen, what they interpreted, how they felt about things, and just basically interviewed them at depth, because there wasn't common knowledge of ghost things back in this time. It wasn't there wasn't TV shows that glorified all this stuff. People had their own opinions, but the real facts weren't really well known in the late 1800s. However, that did change in the early 1900s, and that's when parapsychology kind of had to change the way things were being done. Anyway, now, scientifically speaking, psychical research is what you'd call qualitative study. Qualitative study is, again, basically observations. It's not really formal science. It's just obtaining case studies and looking at this information and disseminating it for facts that can be used to kind of draw general conclusions about certain things that are happening with these particular cases. Now, in 1911, Stanford University began to try to figure out how they could formalize a study with psychical research. How can you take these case studies and how can you take this information and really dig into it? How can you disseminate this information in a way that you could create controlled scientific investigations in a laboratory type setting? That was the big question. So it really started in Stanford University. Now, Duke University wasn't too far behind. About a dozen or so years later, Duke University, with a man named William McDougall, another guy named Carl Zener, and of course, a guy hopefully everyone's familiar with, Joseph Banks Ryan, also known as J.B. Ryan, jumped into parapsychology, what was kind of, didn't really have a name at the time. It was just more or less you know, when Stanford University started to investigate this, it was more or less just taking psychical research to a new level. It was just ghost research. They didn't really have a term for it. It was just trying to apply science. They were really trying to impress some of the scientific agencies out there that were basically calling psychical research on the carpet, just basically saying, this is pseudoscience, this isn't real. What you guys are getting isn't really worth the paper that you're, you know, documenting this stuff on. So they wanted to take this into a strict scientific controlled arena and try to validate it as best as they could to try to prove to the scientific world that all these people that believed in spiritualism weren't just a bunch of kooks. They weren't crazy. And their money spent on seances and things were well worth it. And I'm going to take a quick break right here and just mention to you that you're listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting out of Youngstown, New York on the CJ Mars Radio Network. And this is the Paranormal News Insider with your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And right now I'm talking about parapsychology. And parapsychology, I mentioned the name Joseph Banks Ryan, J.B. Ryan. He's pretty much known as the father of parapsychology. Now, one thing that a lot of people don't know is that he popularized the term parapsychology in a journal in 1937, in a book called New Frontiers of the Mind. Now, the term parapsychology was actually created, first used by a man named Max Dessois in the late 1880s. So he didn't invent the term, but he did make it famous. And his face is pretty much synonymous with parapsychology. And he's pretty much the forefather of parapsychology. Now, parapsychology, as opposed to psychical research, is a little bit more formal. It's a formal scientific study, and you could use the term quantitative. Psychical research is qualitative. It's observation, and parapsychology is quantitative. It's more of a experimental science or using statistics to come to conclusions. So it would be multiple tests over time and generating statistical methods or statistical findings that could be verified by others in controlled laboratory settings. Now, this has its shortcomings. Of course, if you know anything about ghosts, that ghosts don't act on demand. And this unfortunately led to some testing problems, and they weren't able to get the results that they wanted. And unfortunately, some parapsychologists kind of got a little carried away, and there was things called experimenter bias, file drawer effect, some negative things that occurred during these scientific trials that kind of gave parapsychology a black eye. And as we know, paranormal means beyond normal. It can't be explained by normal science. So it was kind of a futile effort, in my opinion, if I'd been around in that time, for them to try to use science on something that's unknown. But it's worth the effort. And through this, these tests, or basically through their research on the case studies, they came up with what was called the Big Three. Now, the Big Three is essentially the big three topics of the paranormal, of parapsychology, essentially. What are those big three things? Essentially, they're the cornerstone of everything that we do. The first part would be ESP. Not ESPN, but ESP. Extrasensory perception. Now, this is known as being receptive, receptive psychic. And it's receptive since information is basically being provided to a person beyond the normal senses. It's also known as telepathy, and is essentially mind-to-mind interaction. Now, it's not reading somebody's mind. Essentially, it's a willing transference of information from one source or one person to another. Now, one aspect of ESP are the clairs. I call them the clairs. There's a lot of clairs. And we know the parent clair is clairvoyance, which is French for clear vision, clear vision. And that's essentially receiving information from objects or events without the use of normal senses or without putting clues together. So it's not using logic. It's not using reading comprehension. It's not anything else that you're using to put that together. Now, the other clairs, there's a whole bunch of them. There's six other clairs. You have claircognizance, which is knowing information without really a logical explanation for why you know that information. Clairaudience, which is sound information gathered from unknown sources. Clairsentience, which is physical sensations that provide information. That's kind of weird. We also have clairalience, or it's also known as clairessence, which is essentially the same term. I don't know why there's two, but there is. That's what I read, which is basically accessing information through smell. Yes, there is such a thing. If you're in a haunting location and suddenly you smell a cigar, and no one is smoking. No one has been smoking in years at this in this room, but the owner who passed away smoked cigars. That is basically a form of clairvoyance or clairessence or clairalience, whatever you want to call it. Whether you're psychic or not, many people who claim to not have any psychic ability have had these things happen, and I have pretty much kind of, I don't want to say a horrible sense of smell, but not a very good sense of smell. But I've also smelled strange odors, not living people, but just significant odors at haunted locations that were very connected to certain individuals that we were investigating. So I believe in that one. Now, the last clair is clairgustance. Now, this is the ability to gather information from taste without food or other objects in the mouth. Never had that happen. I have never met anybody that have had that happen, but hey, it's a clair. She's there. That's what she's for. Now, other aspects of ESP, I've mentioned clairvoyance and the other clairs, telepathy. There's also psychometry. This is the ability to read the history of an object or location. And I mean read, not in pick up like a book, but read through senses other than your regular senses. Now, it's also known that psychometry could potentially be another explanation for hauntings, or one explanation for hauntings, since you're reading the location of a history or object. And we'll talk a little bit more about hauntings here in a second. And also under the ESP heading, you have precognition, which is receiving information about objects or events that occur in the future. And then opposite of that, you would have retrocognition, which is receiving information about objects or events that occurred in the past. Now, obviously, this isn't like Back to the Future where you're picking up a magazine and of past football scores or anything like that. It's through means that you gathered with your senses beyond your normal senses that you're able to gather information that's not readily available about the past. Now, breaking retrocognition down, it's also considered an alternate explanation to psychometry, and as well as with hauntings. So with that, I guess you would explain, in other words, the viewer isn't using the history of an object or location from its electromagnetic field. Rather, the information may be using the object or location as a focal point to the past. Not really in favor with that. I think psychometry would be a better explanation for hauntings. Retrocognition and psychometry are kind of competing theories, but everything is being considered when you're talking about ESP. Now, I mentioned Carl Zener earlier on as one of the core researchers at Duke University, one of the initial people that was involved in the Duke University experiments. And Zener is known for his cards. Now, when you're talking about ESP and ESP testing, essentially cards would be a card guessing game would be one of the ways that you would test for ESP. Now, when they started to use guessing games, they actually did use regular playing cards. That was one of the methods that they started to use early on. People would – there's some issues with that, statistical issues and familiarity with the cards. People would you know, have certain favorite cards or certain favorite suits, and you kind of break down the way the cards are set up with the numbers and suits and everything. It's really wasn't beneficial. So Carl Zener designed his own sets of cards, which had five distinct things on it. It was a star, a circle, plus sign, three wavy lines, and a square. I hope I got that right. And you would have those of those five cards, you'd have five of each of those. You'd have a deck of 25. And what you would do is you'd go through several runs. The more runs you did, the more of a chance you had of seeing somebody who was guessing more often. Of course, they ran into other problems that if you guessed too much, you started to decline. And I'm going to start getting into a little higher things here, but essentially that's how you would test for ESP. Now, the second thing here is psychokinesis, PK. That's number two of the big three. Psychokinesis is my favorite. I think it's awesome. ESP is cool. Being able to read information is awesome. But for me, the exact opposite is even cooler. And psychokinesis is essentially an expressive psychic. ESP, again, is receptive psychic. So with psychokinesis, it's expressive, since there's kind of an exertion of unseen forces onto objects without noticeable or measurable physical means. Very important on that part. One term that people are probably familiar with is telekinesis, and that's essentially the ability to move objects at a distance without normal means. Well, that sounds pretty much exactly like the definition of psychokinesis, and that's one of the reasons why telekinesis is pretty much not used anymore. The parent term of psychokinesis is pretty much taken over that term of telekinesis, but just like ghost investigators, parapsychologists don't agree on terms either, and not all parapsychologists have dumped the term telekinesis. Some use it readily available at all times, but in general, for the most part, telekinesis is kind of lumped into psychokinesis. Pretty much the same term anyway. Now, under the heading of psychokinesis, you have teleportation. This is the movement of an object without it visually having traveled at all. Now, teleportation is an easy one to explain. All you have to do is think of Star Trek and people getting in the teleporter room, and with the planet in view, they would just dissolve and then just reappear on the planet's surface, and vice versa. They would go from the planet up to the ship, and their particles were just essentially taken apart and then reassembled in the teleporter room. And they really didn't travel the distance. Really never explained, I don't think. But essentially, that's how it works. How do objects move around? A teleportation is one of the most interesting pieces when you're dealing with ghost cases, because it happens quite often, and it's quite strange. And one story that I often share is about keys. I had a client who had lost her keys just prior to an investigation. She couldn't find them anywhere. We helped her look. We couldn't find the keys, and about 2 days after the investigation, we get a frantic call. She wants us to come out to her home. We go to her home. She says, something strange happened. I found my keys, and I'm like, well, that's great. Now you have your keys. Why did you call us? Why did we have to drive an hour and a half to your house? And she pointed us down to a room, and she said, you might want to just take a peek in this room and tell me if you see them. She didn't tell us where they were at, but it was just kind of weird that the way she kind of approached it. And as soon as I walked into the room, it was, I think it was early evening, and it was kind of dark. So I flipped on the light and then noticed that the light wasn't as bright as the last time I had been there. The reason for that is you can visually see her keys up in this light fixture. Now, she was pretty short, and there was no bed in the middle of the room, and the first thing I kind of did was I looked down at the floor, I looked at the carpet to see if there was any kind of chair marks or anything that would suggest that maybe she climbed up there, you know, or a ladder or something, and climbed up there and put the keys in there. Now, it took us a little while to get something. We actually had to go to the neighbor's house, if I remember correctly, to get a small step stool to get up there. Even I had a hard time climbing up that high, and I'm 6 foot tall. So I get up there, and I'm examining this dome where the light fixture is, and you can clearly see the keys up there, and this dome is completely covered in dust all the way around it. There are no fingerprints on the bottom, on the top, anywhere. And you had to use your hands, the way this dome was, you had to use your hands high up on this dome to pull it out to get it away from the fixture. And there was no way that anybody put those keys in there, but they weren't there before. So the only explanation essentially is teleportation. There was no way to drop them in from the ceiling or the attic area where it would have been. We crawled up there as well, and there was no way. So that's essentially teleportation. Objects getting into places where they shouldn't be by unusual methods that can't be explained. Now, under psychokinesis, you'd also have psychic healing and psychic surgery. That's basically the means of healing oneself or another with the mind. I guess you'd put Reiki in there and psychic surgery, which really isn't a huge topic anymore. It used to be a big topic in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, but it's kind of gone away. I don't know why. It was kind of a creepy thing. But a lot of it was mentalism anyway. It was just kind of visual trickery. Anyway, the last topic under psychokinesis here is poltergeist. It's a pretty popular term, and when people hear the word poltergeist, it kind of freaks them out. They think of ghosts. But essentially, a poltergeist is essentially, parapsychology figured this out in the 1940s. It's not a ghost or whatever that is called. Noisy ghost is the German term, I think. That's not what scientists discovered. Parapsychologists basically linked this to a living person or persons and to a stress-related situation. And the person who is at the root of all this is typically called an agent. Now, a lot of people will say, well, it's a teenage girl or preteen girl. That is, percentage-wise, the leading example, but it's not always true in every single case. Now, I've only investigated probably three that I can genuinely say more than likely were poltergeists. I can't say beyond the shadow of a doubt, except for one, which I know was the people. The husband and wife were both the agents. They were both the cause of all this. And they were in their early 40s, I believe, if I remember correctly. I think she was maybe in her late 30s. So it was really the both of them, because when one or the other got mad, nothing happened. But when the two of them started to argue, there was all kinds of strange things happening. I only investigated one case where there was a child involved in what I would feel is a poltergeist case, and it was a young boy, and he was nowhere near being going through puberty. He was only 8 years old, or almost nine, I think, at the time. So for me, statistically speaking, not really something that I would consider, but a lot of people tend to believe that. And a lot of parapsychologists also believe that because of statistics and because of the amount of times that a girl is typically at that. Now, we mentioned Zener cards and regular playing cards as a test for ESP. How would you test psychokinesis? Well, a number of early tests would include falling dice. That would be a macro kind of test. Think, what was it, episode one of Star Wars, where Qui-Gon Jinn was trying to win the freedom of young Anakin Skywalker, and they threw down the chance cubes, and he waved his little hand and did the force and made the cubes fall exactly how he wanted. And that would be an extreme case of psychokinesis, an extreme case of controlling the dice fall. That's not essentially how it works. It's more or less, in this case with psychokinesis, would be overtime. It would be dozens of throws over time, because statistically speaking, you're going to get certain numbers a certain amount of times if it's done with a controlled methodology, not just by hand. So you pretty much know where the dice are going to fall. And if a person is able to beat the odds, and again, the more falls that happen, the better. But over time, you would see a decline in that attempt. Now, at a micro level, you would talk about random number generators, people influencing random number generators. A lot of those things are available online. You can try it yourself. See if you have psychokinesis. If just don't break your computer doing it is all I recommend. The third piece here of the big three that we're going to talk about tonight on parapsychology is the big one, survival of bodily death. This includes apparitions and hauntings, which I use as the general blanket terms. Some people like to use true apparition or true haunting or residual haunting and blah, blah, blah. So many different words. I keep it simple. And when I talk about apparition, what I essentially mean is what is seen, heard, felt, or smelled, and somehow related to part of the human personality or mind that can somehow exist in our physical universe after the death of the body. And when people hear the word apparition, they tend to think of a visual type of thing. The ghost, you know, the person floating, maybe doesn't have legs. You see the torso, it's wearing a white dress, it's spooky, it's scary. But again, it's also what is heard, felt, or smelled that's related to the personality. But the biggest thing about an apparition is basically two big things, intelligence and communication. In order for it to be a true apparition, it would have to have these two key components, intelligence. It would have to have some sort of intelligence. So there'd have to be some kind of rational meaning behind the behavior that you're observing or is happening to a client. It might be the focus of particular events on a specific person or the obvious ability to gain attention through methods that are way beyond coincidence. And that would be how it would demonstrate intelligence. Now, communication. Communication can be gathered incorrectly. You know, we see something, we hear something, we assume that it's communication, or we ask questions, and any kind of response we would assume is communication. But it would have to be an obvious attempt at gaining the attention of the living. And there's an understanding of information passed between them and the living. So in the case of the woman and her car keys, her being upset every time anything happened and wanting to leave, I think that was kind of this apparition's way of telling her, no, you're not going anywhere. So that's essentially an apparition. Then you have a haunting, which I think a lot of people would understand what a haunting is. Residual haunting, however you want to describe it. True haunting, whatever. I just use the term haunting. Basically describes residual activity referring to a location or even an object. Again, no communication or direct relationship with the living. No communication. Sometimes referred to as a residual haunting. And an apparition would sometimes be called intelligent hauntings. Again, I think that's confusing. So those two are the main two pieces of the survival piece. You would also have under survival studies, survival of bodily death, you'd have shared death experience. That's essentially a living person's is experiencing another's death or dying experience, or is able to sense the death process of the person. You'd also have a crisis apparition, which is observing or interacting with somebody who is about to, going through, or one who has just gone through the death or dying process, and usually within 72 hours. Not a hard, fast rule, but that's, again, statistically speaking, that's typically within that time frame prior to or after. And it's usually loved ones. It's usually somebody you're very close with, family member, or loved one, or somebody that you've spent a lot of time with. Crisis apparition essentially is just a way of saying goodbye or making amends or whatnot. But don't panic if you see somebody that shouldn't be there. Don't assume that they're crisis apparition. We'd also have near-death experiences, NDEs, and out-of-body experiences, OBEs. You'd also have deathbed visions where a dying person receives a visit from a deceased family member. Now, PSI, P-S-I, is the all-inclusive word for ESP, PK, and survival of bodily death. So it's the inclusive word for the big three. Now, again, I mentioned earlier that psi exists beyond scientific explanation, so it defies many laws of nature, despite a lot of people trying to classify it or to say, well, you know, the theory of thermodynamics explains ghosts. Well, no, it doesn't, because the paranormal exists beyond normal. It exists beyond nature. We can't explain it by normal means. So it's kind of difficult for parapsychology to prove any of this stuff by using pure science. And they've kind of, in a way, kind of handcuffed themselves by using science. And they really hit a barrier in testing and kind of hurt the paranormal field more than anything, to be honest. And it's been a struggle to really get back out in the field and to continue the research. And that's what's really happened in the 70s and 80s when funding dried up for parapsychology. And now we're at a point where those of us amateurs are going out into the field. We're not really conducting controlled scientific studies anymore. And we're just kind of doing the way psychical research did. But those of us like myself invented the E4 method of client-based paranormal investigations, which does take a little bit about psychical research and parapsychology and tries to cram it into a methodology that everybody can use. So I guess the big question would be with parapsychology is, how can parapsychology define what it is attempting to explain when it is limited by the context in which it operates? That's your thinking cap thing for the week. Parapsychology, you know, is glorified by a lot of people, but it's really, it's kind of run its course. It only gathered enough information to get us to a specific point in time. And it's really a dying subject, unfortunately and sadly. But that's pretty much it. Now, I'm not a big fan of statistics, but if you were to poll the jury about the two between intelligent communicative apparitions and residual hauntings, if you were to ask paranormal groups out there, the overwhelming majority of them would say that hauntings happen more often, which is kind of funny when you think about it. And it's funny because when you think about it, ghost groups will specifically say, yes, hauntings happen more often than apparitions. However, when you look at the methodology, when you look at the way groups approach cases, they use their tools and technology, what do? What's the first thing that they do? They ask questions. Is there anyone here who would like to speak to us? Please tell us your name. Kind of crazy. Because that kind of flies against the statistics or goes against the beliefs in the field that people have that, these intelligent things aren't really occurring as much as the residual hauntings. And, you know, you go to any prison, you go to any hospital, a majority of the stuff that you're going to get is all residual information. And, it is. It's few and far between to get that true apparition, and very rare in my experiences. I would kind of agree with what Frank is saying. He says about 60-70% residual and 30-40% intelligent. Yes, depending upon the types of cases, and I agree with that. It's I hate putting statistics on stuff like that. That's just touchy-feely. A lot of it's based on perception. Now, we can perceive that something is communicating with us, but is it really communicating with us? Or is that just our perception of what's going on with that? We'll never know. Kind of running short on time here to talk too much in depth about conferences and conventions, but there's a lot of stuff going on this weekend, especially. MUFON is having a conference in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania MUFON will be holding the Philadelphia UFO Conference October 9th and 10th. Dr. David Jacobs, Nick Pope, Mike Barra, Richard Dolan, John Ventry, and a lot of other big-name people in the UFO field are going to be there. Visit MUFONPA.com for details on that. There's a lot of other MUFON events. Phoenix MUFON has one on October 25th. November 14th, another Pennsylvania MUFON in Pittsburgh this time. UFO conference, November 14th. Lauren Coleman, John Ventry, Stan Gordon will also be there. And again, all this stuff, Those two are available at MUFONPA.com. A number of other MUFON-based events happening throughout the country. MUFON basically puts on a majority of the UFO conferences that you're going to find. Also, this weekend, we have the East Coast Paracon, October 10th in Pittstown Township, Pennsylvania. A lot of local people are going to be at that event. Those are usually some of the best ones to go to if you live anywhere in that area. I believe that's about 100 miles north of Philadelphia, up near Scranton, if I remember correctly. So if you're anywhere in that area within about 2-3 hour drive, I highly recommend that. Again, those local kind of events really draw people, the local ones. And it's a great networking opportunity. And to check out the entire list of events, conferences, conventions, paranormal classes, tours, guided hunts, you name it, for ghosts, for UFOs, for cryptozoology, ParanewsInsider.com. And click on the events tab at the top. And as always, if you have any information about any event and would like to hear it here, as well as have it listed on the website, let me know at insider@paranewsinsider.com or click on the about contact tab at the top of paranewsinsider.com and let me know any information you have about any event anywhere. And for those of you listening live, cjmarsradio.com, you might want to stay around, stick around an hour from now. My good buddy David Considine is going to be on Paranormalities and Ponderings with another good buddy of mine, Frank Lee. So don't miss that. That's at 9 p.m. Eastern. So you got a little bit of a break to sharpen your pencils. Thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Don't stop believing. Have a good night. See you next week.
Listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York, the CJ Mars Radio Network.